of America.
Good morning, Africa. Today is Friday, February 26th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, a look at how some African countries are rolling out COVID-19 vaccines.
Senegal is due to receive nearly 1.3 million vaccine doses through the World Health Organization-led COVAX initiative.
Also ahead, the history behind Black History Month.
The majority community did not know about the tremendous contributions that African Americans and those of African descent had made.
Plus, we meet a South African musician producing music during lockdown. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is COVID-19 vaccines in Africa. Numerous African countries are kicking off COVID-19 vaccination campaigns. Earlier this week, the COVAX program delivered its first shots to Ghana, but there is some mistrust over vaccine efficacy. So in some countries, health ministers are among the first ones to take the shots. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports on Senegal and Zimbabwe, two countries that have been vaccinating their populations using Sinovac, the Chinese-made COVID-19 vaccine.
Senegal received 200,000 doses of the Chinese-made COVID-19 vaccine last week and started vaccinating on Tuesday. Health Minister Abdoulaye Diouf Sarr was the first in line to mark what he called a historic day.
Senegal is one of seven countries among the 54 countries of the African continent to start the vaccination against COVID-19.
Priorities include healthcare workers, people over 60, and those with underlying health conditions. Sarr says in addition to the Chinese vaccine, the country is also looking at other possibilities to increase their stock.
The head of state is now finalizing talks with Russia to enable us to soon receive the Sputnik V. During the month of March, Senegal will also receive its first batch of the COVAX initiative.
Senegal is due to receive nearly 1.3 million vaccine doses through the World Health Organization-led COVAX initiative, which deployed a batch of 600,000 in Ghana this week as part of a first wave of coronavirus vaccines being sent to a number of low- and middle-income countries. In Zimbabwe, Vice President Constantino Chiwenga, also the country's health minister, volunteered for the first Chinese-made vaccine as well. Amid reports of public mistrust over vaccine safety, Chiwenga said his ministry had done its homework.
My ministry conducted all scientific processes to ascertain the efficacy of Sinopharm vaccine, which was confirmed to be 79%.
Zimbabwe received 200,000 doses from the Sinopharm vaccine as a donation from the Chinese government. Another 600,000 doses purchased by Zimbabwe are expected to arrive early next week, according to government officials. Vaccine recipient Michael Chideme says he's relieved to have taken the shot, but
taking the jab does not mean I will not be able to, I will not get the disease if I don't practice caution. But I'll be extra cautious, but I'm happy I've taken the jab.
Zimbabwe, like many other African countries, initially recorded low coronavirus numbers in the first months of the pandemic, but subsequently saw cases go up. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
European health experts say that thousands of COVID-19 patients continue to suffer serious, debilitating, and lingering symptoms many months after their initial bout of infection. Saraya Ali of Reuters reports.
European health experts say thousands of COVID-19 patients continue to suffer serious, debilitating, and lingering symptoms many months after their initial bout of infection, with major social, health, and economic consequences. That's according to a World Health Organization-led report on the condition often referred to as long COVID or post-COVID syndrome. Hans Kluger is the WHO's European Regional Director.
Today, we shed light on the fact that in some patients, the disability following SARS-CoV-2 infection lingers on for months with severe social, economic, health, and occupational consequences. The burden is real and it is significant. About 1 in 10 COVID-19 sufferers remain unwell after 12 weeks, and many for much longer.
An initial report by Britain's National Institute for Health Research last year suggested long COVID may be not one condition, but multiple syndromes causing a roller coaster of symptoms affecting the body and mind. Kluger noted that as with any new disease, much remains unknown about COVID-19. He urged health authorities to listen to patients' concerns, take them seriously, and establish services to help them.
That was Reuters' Soraya Ali. The first big real-world study of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine to be independently reviewed shows the shot is highly effective at preventing COVID-19. The study was conducted in Israel. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
In a promising sign for the global fight against COVID-19, the two-dose Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine has been shown to be about as effective in the real world as it was in its trials. On Wednesday, the first study of the vaccine in the wild, conducted in Israel, found it was 94% effective in preventing the disease. It's now 2 months into Israel's vaccine rollout, which has been one of the fastest in the world. Until now, there's been some uncertainty as to just how effective coronavirus vaccines have been outside the controlled conditions of clinical trials. But Israel's centralized health system provides a rich source of data, showing that among those given both doses of the Pfizer vaccine, there were 94% fewer symptomatic COVID-19 cases across all age groups. Nearly half of Israel's 9 million people have already received their first dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, and a third have already received both of them. As COVID-19 infections fall, Israel has relaxed its third national lockdown and reopened malls, shops, schools, and many workplaces in the past 2 weeks. Recreational venues like theaters, gyms, hotels, and even concerts opened on Sunday, but only for holders of a green pass, a government certificate showing they have either been fully vaccinated against or recovered from COVID-19 and presumed immune. Also on Wednesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said all eligible Israelis age 16 and older were expected to be vaccinated by the end of March, allowing a full reopening of the economy by as early as April 5th.
Thanks to Gloria So of Reuters for that report. Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz said Thursday that the country has frozen its program to send extra COVID-19 vaccines abroad to buy international goodwill. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faced heavy criticism for the so-called vaccine diplomacy plan, including from Palestinians who have received few vaccines from Israel. Before the freeze, Israel had sent Honduras and the Czech Republic several thousand vaccine doses each. Nearly half of Israel's population of 9 million people have received a first vaccine dose, but Israel has given just 2,000 doses to the Palestinian Authority. There are 5.2 million Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and Gaza. They have received about 32,000 total doses from various sources amid controversy over whether Israel is responsible for supplying the vaccine to Palestinians. The World Bank says that the COVID-19 test positivity rate in the West Bank is over 21% and 29% in Gaza, indicating uncontrolled spread of the virus. Gaza's southern crossing into Egypt has been open for 2 weeks, and some life is beginning to trickle back into the economy of a border town that had nowhere to go. Reuters' Lucy Fielder reports.
A fleet of yellow taxis line up outside Gaza's newly reopened Rafah crossing into Egypt. Polished and ready to roll, but who knows for how long. It's been 2 weeks since one of Gaza's few gates to the outside world swung open, after years of blockade. Life is trickling back into the economy. Jaber Abu Talal is a transit taxi driver who relies on the crossing.
It's good that the crossing is open. We will make a living. When the crossing is closed, we stay at home. These cars have no work inside the town.
What unlocked the door were Egyptian brokered talks between rival Palestinian factions to smooth the way for possible elections. Egypt had been opening Rafah rarely, and for just a few days at a time. There's no airport in Gaza, and an Israeli-led blockade on people and goods has inflicted grave hardship for years. Hepatitis patient Uday Zanin was waiting to board a bus.
It's a lifeline for the Gaza Strip and its people. We don't have another crossing. Our only crossing is Rafah, crossing to Egypt and then on to other countries. When it's closed, Gaza is dead and we feel like we're in prison. When it's open, we can breathe and travel where we want.
About 2 million Palestinians live in the 140-square-mile Gaza Strip, where uncertainty is a fact of life. Israel and Egypt cite security concerns for the restrictions, pointing to the fact that Gaza is controlled by the Islamist militant group Hamas.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. This is VOA. Rights group Amnesty International says Eritrean soldiers killed hundreds of civilians in Ethiopia's ancient town of Aksum between November 28th and 29th last year. The report cited 41 witnesses. The rights group says the mass execution of civilians by Eritrean troops may amount to crimes against humanity. The Ethiopian government's emergency task force for the Tigray conflict said Thursday that investigations into violence in Aksum were underway. The state-run Ethiopian Human Rights Commission released a statement timed to coincide with the Amnesty report, saying preliminary investigations indicated that Eritrean soldiers had killed an unknown number of civilians in Aksum in retaliation for an earlier attack by soldiers of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which is battling the government of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Eritrea's Foreign Minister Osman Saleh Mohammed did not respond to requests for comments from Reuters. Both Ethiopia and Eritrea have previously denied that Eritrean troops were in Ethiopian territory. The TPLF and many residents say Eritrea intervened to support Ethiopian soldiers after the TPLF attacked government bases in the early hours of November 4th. Brazil's health ministry reported Thursday that its COVID-19 outbreak has killed over a quarter million people. That's the second highest death toll on Earth after the U.S. The ministry reported over 1,500 deaths in the last 24 hours, the second highest daily death toll since the pandemic hit the country a year ago. The South American country has registered over 10.3 million cases, which is the world's third largest outbreak outside the U.S. and India. Listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. February is Black History Month in the United States. As the month draws to a close, VOA's Adam Phillips takes a look at the story behind the yearly celebration. He spoke to Sylvia Cyrus, who is the executive director of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. She begins by talking about her organization's founder, Dr. Carter Woodson, and his role in creating Black History Month.
He knew that part of the reason why there was so much racial strife was that the majority community did not know about the tremendous contributions that African Americans and those of African descent had made. And that is the reason why he started Negro History Week in 1926. He developed this celebration around February 12th and February 14th, the birthday of Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, respectively, because after the Civil War, Black people were commemorating and celebrating these 2 days.
It's interesting that Dr. Woodson made the celebration of Black history in general the focus. He didn't view it as a way to idealize particular famous people at all.
Dr. Woodson knew that it was the race, not just simply heroic and notable individuals, that needed to be celebrated and studied. And so his vision was to take the study of different historic events, different cultural aspects of Black life, and to make that the focus.
I know some activists have kind of criticized Martin Luther King's birthday, which is a national holiday here in the U.S. They say it's too focused on one man.
Right. Well, we take nothing away from Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, because although it celebrates the life of one individual, it really represents the entire civil rights movement. There were so many individuals, well-known as well as individuals who will never know their names, that really stand behind that holiday. So we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday as a day of service for individuals to give back to their communities and what the community should be doing to support all aspects of American and world life and history.
Some have complained that making February Black History Month is a sort of secret snub, because February is, of course, the shortest month.
That's not true, and that's part of the education that here at ASALA, the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, that we tell. There was once an attempt to make February History Month, and it failed. But when we added the importance of the struggle and triumphs of Black people in America, that took hold, and it had America look at its history, the good parts and some of the challenges, and it has been a wonderful way to embrace diversity, a way that we can look at ourselves and look at some of the frailties that we have in some of the areas that we have to strengthen in terms of what we do. And because Black people are still creating history, we think it is fitting. We focus our attention on the contributions of those who were enslaved, brought here against their own will, as well as other Black people who did come here of their own will and have helped build America.
Why make it only a month?
There are so many Black people who have made significant contributions to world history and specifically United States history, that if we tried to have a celebration for every day that someone should be recognized, we would run out of days.
I know your organization has a very special theme all this year, the Black family. Tell us why you chose that.
We are particularly delighted in this year's theme. Not enough can be said about how important the Black family is. Black families have been where a lot of the strength has really come from. And we're celebrating how important what you learn in the family structure is. The starting point where people learn about who they are, the strength of who they are, the importance of who they are, it is so important in terms of what one generation passes down to the next. And there are stories that individuals are finding out that they did not know of courageous individuals who have been in families who really inspire young people to do better because of those who have gone on before them.
Ms. Sylvia Cyrus, thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're so welcome, and thank you so much for allowing me to really talk to this important audience, our brothers and sisters on the African continent. We have been doing our best to reach out and develop that bridge so that we're talking to each other more, understanding each other more, and really celebrating each other.
That was Sylvia Cyrus, Executive Director of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips. As the U.S. Congress continues probing last month's riot at the U.S. Capitol, lawmakers are pushing the Capitol Police's acting chief on why more was not done to stop the insurrection by supporters of former President Trump. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
Yogananda Pittman says officials knew armed extremists might attack Congress, but nothing indicated just how bad the attack would get.
There was no such intelligence.
Saying Capitol Police did boost security. At a House hearing, Congressman Tim Ryan says it's clear Pittman and others failed to understand all the signs pointing to a worst-case attack.
I feel like you didn't put it all together and synthesize it in a way, go, holy cow, I mean, something really bad can happen here.
Pittman says in hindsight, more should have been done, chalking it up to lessons learned. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Authorities in the U.S. say that former U.S. Olympic gymnastics coach John Gettert has died by suicide following the publication of charges against him of human trafficking and sexual assault. Gettert had ties to convicted child abuser Larry Nassar, who was Gettert's team doctor for about 20 years. Gettert was charged with 20 counts of human trafficking, one count of first-degree sexual assault, one count of of second-degree sexual assault, criminal enterprise, and lying to a police officer. Gettert's attorney's office confirms that he was deceased but declined further comment. Gettert was suspended by USA Gymnastics in 2018. Facebook on Thursday said it had banned the Myanmar military from using its Facebook and Instagram platforms with immediate effect. The move follows weeks of mass demonstrations in the Southeast Asian country after the military seized power. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
Facebook on Thursday said it had banned Myanmar's military from its platforms, Facebook and Instagram. Facebook said in a blog post, quote, "Events since the February 1st coup, including deadly violence, have precipitated a need for this ban." Facebook's ban came due to what the company calls, quote, "severe human rights abuses and a clear risk of future military-initiated violence." The company added it would also ban advertisements from all military-linked commercial entities. The army detained Democratic Party leaders earlier this month, including the popular figure Aung San Suu Kyi, after alleging fraud in the November election, in which Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy had won in a landslide. In 2018, Facebook banned Myanmar's army chief and 19 other senior officers and organizations, and took down hundreds of accounts run by military members for spreading false or propaganda content. Ahead of the most recent November elections, Facebook announced it had taken down a network of 70 fake accounts and pages operated by members of the military. Despite those efforts, the tech giant said on Thursday that attempts had been made to rebuild those army-run networks on its platform.
Also in tech news, Australia's federal parliament Thursday gave its final approval to a law to make Google and Facebook pay for news content posted on their platforms. The legislation is the first of its kind in the world. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The News Media and Digital Platforms Mandatory Bargaining Code gained final parliamentary approval Thursday and will soon become law when it's formally approved by Governor-General David John Hurley. The legislation is designed to make Facebook and Google pay for news items on their platforms, but government amendments allow them to negotiate financial deals with Australian news organisations. If that process fails, the digital platforms would be forced into arbitration. Much has changed in the past few days. Last week, Facebook blocked Australian users from sharing or viewing news stories on its platform. The move was a direct challenge to the Australian government over contentious social media regulation. The ban had widespread implications. According to a Reuters Institute report, up to 40% of Australians turned to Facebook for news between 2018 and 2020. Facebook insisted that media companies benefited the most from this arrangement because it increased internet traffic and revenue to their websites. Traditional media companies complained that Facebook and Google were profiting from their journalism without paying for it. There followed a tense standoff between one of the world's most successful technology companies and senior ministers in Canberra. Days of negotiations led to concessions on both sides, and Facebook reversed its news blackout in Australia. The head of Australia's Competition and Consumer Commission, Rod Sims, says he hopes the legislation will curb the immense power of the two dominant digital platforms.
Google and Facebook need media, but they don't need any particular media company. And that meant media companies couldn't do commercial deals with Facebook or Google. The purpose of the code is to give them the potential for arbitration, which helps their bargaining position and therefore helps them reach fair commercial deals.
Google had threatened to withdraw its primary search engine from Australia, but it has signed deals with major publishers and broadcasters worth collectively about $47 million. Facebook has signed at least one deal with Seven West Media, a major Australian media company, and is in negotiations with other Australian media companies. Analysts have said that Facebook's ban last week on Australian news content was intended as a warning to lawmakers in other parts of the world, including Britain and Canada, who are watching carefully Australia's attempt at social media regulation. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
What's it like being a musician during COVID-19? Award-winning South African DJ Sunil Musician discusses the challenges of releasing an album under lockdown. Emmer McCarthy of Reuters has more.
Hi, I'm Sunil Musician. I'm a DJ, producer, singer-songwriter, and this is what I do.
For Sanele Sitole, better known as Sunil Musician, the lockdown hasn't stopped him from doing what he does best. Creating the kind of music that's already made him a household name in South African dance and house circles.
So I'm able to take gospel into dance, Zulu folk music, you name it. I can basically take anything and just fuse it with that.
Last year, the award-winning music producer followed up his debut album, Africa to the World, with To the World and Beyond. 31 tracks featuring big names from the continent, including Nigeria's Niniola and Kenya's Satui Sol. But collaborating was a challenge.
Everything was just virtual. Emails, in and out, songs got lost. Certain final versions are not on the final album, but hey, it's only me who knows that, you know. But it's beautiful. It's out there. People are really loving it. Yeah, I'm getting so much positive feedback from it. And it's amazing. It's amazing. It's just been a very stressful but beautiful project.
He says it was made even harder because his process involves having the artists next to him. Soulful singer Simi worked on the album.
So he will just interview you, find out who you are, and then move to the music side and be like, okay, music, what do you love? And right now, if I would play this, what would you say?
Sunil has been using social media to share music videos and get feedback on the album and address issues close to his heart, such as Inotia Tuhuru, which addresses abuses by police against black people. He's also organised virtual concerts and is looking at other ways to diversify, as he says it's impossible to predict if live events will be returning at their previous scale.
That was Emmer McCarthy of Reuters, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, and our editor, Bill Eagle, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Human trafficking is a bipartisan concern in foreign policy for the United States. In fact, the year that began with the presidential transition also started with National Slavery and Human Trafficking Month, which the U.S. has been observing by presidential proclamations for the past 11 years. The State Department made that announcement on Inauguration Day. Indeed, incoming Secretary of State Antony Blinken dated U.S. policy on human trafficking back to the Lincoln years. More than 150 years after President Lincoln's promise of freedom, an estimated 24.9 million individuals around the world are exploited by human traffickers, Secretary Blinken stated when he designated February 1, 2021, as National Freedom Day. For example, the State Department Trafficking in Persons, or TIP report, lists a number of countries which conscript children to serve as soldiers, including Afghanistan, Burma, Cameroon, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Iran, and Iraq. Of course, the report also shows the degree to which human traffickers also engage in sexual exploitation. For instance, according to the TIP report, in Cuba, the government did not criminalize all forms of forced labor or sex trafficking. In Iran, during the reporting period, there continued to be a government policy or pattern of recruiting and using child soldiers, and a pattern of government officials perpetrating sex trafficking of adults and children with impunity. More than 20 years ago, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, or TVPA, of 2000, enshrined the United States' commitment to combating modern slavery domestically and internationally, according to the State Department. With this bipartisan law, the United States reaffirmed the fundamental promise of forever free, enshrined within the Emancipation Proclamation. That was an